Well, good afternoon, listeners. You're listening to the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools, and we're here to defend and to promote public education. And we have some very interesting material for you today. Our friend Trevor Cobbald up there in the ACT has been vindicated. He's been doing all of this facts and figures finding. He used to work for the Productivity Commission. And he is a real nerd when it comes to facts and figures. And he has been saying for, oh, it must be well over a year, that our public schools have been denied over $200 billion in funding by the Albanese government's agreements of 2023, which looks forward to 2034. But a new report by the National School Resourcing Board has revealed that his facts and figures are pretty much on the money. Let's hear about it from Andy in our press release number 1055, which you'll find on our website at www.adogs.info. But over to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools. Press release number 1055. Trevor Cobbald from Save Our Schools vindicated. It's official. Accounting tricks denied public schools over $2 billion in funding in 2023. For many years, Trevor Cobbald from Save Our Schools has been producing facts and figures on their website, which prove that while Australian private schools are overfunded, public schools are underfunded. Part of the reason for this is that state treasurers and private school sympathisers in state bureaucracies have literally corked the books. But a new report by the National School Resourcing Board, the NSRB, has vindicated Trevor Cobbald and all his hard work. Under the Australian Education Act 2013, the National School Resourcing Board is required to conduct an annual review of state and territory compliance with Section 22A of the Act. Section 22A states that as a condition of Commonwealth financial assistance, states and territories are required to meet minimum school funding contributions. These are set out in their bilateral agreements with the Commonwealth under the National School Reform Agreement. The terms of reference for the review ask the Board to take into account the terms of bilateral agreements with individual jurisdictions under the National School Reform Agreement, mitigating and contributing factors that have contributed to any non-compliance, and timing of state budget processes and impact on compliance and reporting arrangements. Trevor Cobbald points out that the 2024 report reveals that public schools lost over $2 billion in funding in 2023 because of accounting tricks used by state governments under the Commonwealth-state funding agreements operating at the time. The accounting tricks are continued under the new funding agreements signed this year. They mean that public schools will remain underfunded for the next 10 years. The report reviewed compliance by state and territory governments with requirements of the funding agreements for 2023. The agreements outline funding transition pathways for each year from 2018 until 2023, later extended to 2024. Each state and territory must meet a minimum funding requirement based on the relevant schooling resource standard, SRS, shares specified for their agreed transition pathways for public and private school sectors. Under the agreements, all states and territories except the ACT could claim expenditures specifically excluded from how the SRS is measured as part of their share of funding the SRS of public schools. They could claim two types of non-SRS expenditures. Up to 4% of the total SRS for school transport, capital depreciation, as well as preschool in Western Australia and early childhood education in the Northern Territory. Expenditures by regulatory authorities such as curriculum and standards bodies, but not in the Northern Territory. New South Wales could only claim this as part of its 4% allowance. The board reported that the states claimed $2.34 billion for these expenditures in 2023. It represents a loss of funding for public schools because the states have used non-SRS expenditures instead of eligible SRS funding in meeting their share of the SRS in public schools. The funding loss estimated by the NSRB is only slightly less than the $2.35 billion previously estimated by Save Our Schools. The biggest funding losses were incurred by public schools in New South Wales, Victoria, and Queensland. $641 million, $628 million and $568 million respectively. Public schools in Western Australia lost $237 million, but this is an underestimate of the full loss because the NSRB report does not include expenditure by the Western Australian government on education regulatory authorities. Public schools in South Australia lost $171 million. Prior to amendment of the Education Act in 2024, Commonwealth government funding of public schools was limited to 20% of their SRS, and state and territory governments were responsible for the other 80%. However, the previous funding agreements failed to ensure full funding by state and territory governments. The funding shares for the states and the Northern Territory for 2023 were all less than 80%. The specified shares failed to take account of the accounting tricks. In reality, state and territory governments, except the ACT, were funding public schools at far less than 80%. For example, while the reported New South Wales government share met the 80% target, the actual share was only 76%. The data provided by the NSRAB report allows estimation of the full extent of this underfunding of public schools by state and territory governments in 2023. Based on the report's figures, SOS now estimates that public schools were underfunded by $5.1 billion in 2023. This is substantially less than the SOS's previous estimate of $6.9 billion. The difference is largely due to the New South Wales government funding public schools by $1.3 billion more than required by its bilateral agreement with the Commonwealth. The report also shows that Queensland, Western Australia, Tasmania and the ACT contributed slightly more funding than required by their agreements. Public schools in Victoria were underfunded by $2.1 billion, $1.4 billion in Queensland and nearly $600 million in New South Wales. By contrast, all governments except Victoria and the Northern Territory were funding private schools at the level required by the agreements or were overfunding private schools. The level of underfunding of private schools in Victoria and Northern Territory was negligible compared to that of public schools. The New South Wales government overfunded private schools by $209 million. The total overfunding of private schools by state governments in 2023 was $242 million. It should be noted that the Commonwealth government also overfunded private schools in 2023 by an estimated $766 million. Total Commonwealth and state overfunding amounted to $1 billion. The refusal of state governments to fully fund public schools, which are their primary responsibility, while continuing to overfund private schools is deplorable. It is another indication of the extent to which the school funding system is biased against public schools. But the discrimination in favour of private schools runs even deeper. State governments defrauded public schools by claiming non-SRS expenditures such as depreciation, school transport and expenditure on regulatory authorities as part of their share of funding public schools. However, they did not claim such expenditures as part of their share of funding private schools. Private school students also receive school transport subsidies and private schools are also regulated by state government authorities. The new NSRB report is official confirmation that the previous Commonwealth-state funding agreements were heavily biased against public schools. Under the agreements, public schools incurred major losses of funding each year because of accounting tricks in the agreements. Incredibly, the new funding agreements signed earlier this year continue the underfunding of public schools for another 10 years. The agreements do provide for the removal of the 4% allowance on capital depreciation, but it will not be fully removed until 2034. Governments can continue to claim expenditure on regulatory authorities, and they have a new separate allowance to claim expenditure on school transport for public school students. SOS estimates that public schools will still be underfunded by over $1.7 billion in 2034. The underfunding estimates are New South Wales, $888 million, Queensland, $425 million, South Australia, $120 million, Western Australia, $192 million, Tasmania, $37 million, and the Northern Territory, $53 million by 2029. The cumulative underfunding over 10 years is $34.6 billion. These estimates include likely underfunding of Victorian public schools because the funding agreement is not published. It is scandalous that there is still no Victorian agreement when the school year is nearly over. Commonwealth government officials told Senate estimates earlier this month that no agreement had been signed to date. The Victorian government is notorious for its neglect of public schools. It has long underfunded public schools, and they are likely to be underfunded by at least $1.5 billion in 2025. The claim by the Victorian government that Victoria is the education state is a complete misnomer. The government continues to fail public schools. By 2034, it will be 23 years after the Gonski report recommended that public schools be fully funded according to a schooling resource standard. The continuing underfunding of public schools represents a lamentable and egregious failure by governments to support greater equity in education. The situation demands that funding agreements be revised to ensure public schools are fully funded by 2029. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, that's all very interesting, isn't it? I know that we get a little bit shell-shocked with all of the corruption that is around and about, even in our much beloved bureaucracy and in our much beloved democracy of Australia. But I think this indicates that within our state education departments, we don't always have people who are dedicated to the well-being of our public schools, largely because they send their children off to private schools, don't they? If it was a private school, then they would be required to have a commitment to their education system, but we're a little bit more lax in the education system, the public education system, a bit more tolerant than that, unfortunately. But this lack of funding has its implications at the school level. And in the next week, next Wednesday, in fact, there's going to be a very interesting demonstration about the billions in funding that the state government are not giving to our public system. And this is a Labor government, listeners. I think that, it's certainly Labor light, isn't it? Let's hear from our great producer, Dale, who will be hopefully going to find out more about this protest and the people from the AEU who will be running it. Let's hear about it all from Dale.
Each week here on The Dogs, we talk about how badly underfunded state schools are. Teachers are getting together to have a rally. So this is a call out to state school communities to get to this rally on Wednesday, the 12th of November. The rally is at the office of Anthony Carbines, MP, which is at 149 Burgundy Street in Heidelberg. The rally begins at 4:30 p.m. 12th of November, 149 Burgundy Street, Heidelberg. This rally is to protest the delayed funding of $2.4 billion to public schools. There are many, many issues at play here, but overall, the protest is about the broken promises that are affecting staffing, they're affecting teachers, and they're affecting kids. The kids who need it most are falling in the cracks. As we all know, and we talk about it every week here on the Dogs program, public schools do the heaviest lifting with the least resources, and it's time to shout no more. So join the rally cry on Wednesday, the 12th of November, 149 Burgundy Street, Heidelberg, at 4:30 p.m. Those details again, 149 Burgundy Street, Heidelberg, the offices of Anthony Carbines, MP, at 4:30 p.m. And add your voice to the fight for full and fair funding. Funding delayed is funding denied. On the 12th of November at 4:30 p.m. at 149 Burgundy Street, Heidelberg. Join these brave teachers and state school communities.
Thank you so much, Dale. And of course, if you feel strongly about this, or if you're a unionist, then it's 149 Burgundy Street, Heidelberg, 4:30 p.m. on Wednesday, the 12th of November next. And if you can't get there, then you'll hear a lot more about it from 3CR and the Dogs program. But let's have a break, shall we?
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy. Aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan, All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program. As we've said, funding, it's the economy stupid. Well, in education, it's always the funding stupid. And where Mr. Albanese and our Labor government here in Victoria are not giving our public schools the funding, they're quite happy to indulge in a little bit of restructuring. So they're making major school reforms, which are, they say, aimed to lift teaching and learning across Australia. Let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. Major school reforms aim to lift teaching and learning across Australia. And this was published in The Educator on the 31st of October. Australia's education system is on the cusp of major changes, with the federal and state governments agreeing to a raft of reforms aimed at making schools fairer, better funded, and more effective. At the recent Education Ministers meeting, Education Ministers agreed on the next steps, unveiling plans to create a new Australian Teaching and Learning Commission, overhaul the maths curriculum in the first 3 years of school, and update national teacher standards for the first time in 15 years. The Federal Education proposed Teaching and Learning Commission will see ACARA, AITSL, AERO and Education Services Australia merged with the goal of creating stronger links between curriculum design, teacher development, research and classroom practice. A working group will present a detailed plan in February following consultation with teachers, school leaders, First Nations representatives and unions. The Australian Primary Principals Association President, Angela Falkenberg, says she and her members are especially cautious about whether structural change alone will address the complex challenges facing schools and, in particular, principals. Falkenberg said three areas, curriculum, assessment and valuing the profession, must be prioritised if the Commission is to make a real difference. We have consistently called for a curriculum that is coherent, age-appropriate and achievable within the time available, Falkenberg told The Educator. This is not about endless curriculum debates, but about trusting teachers, skilled credentialed professionals, to design learning that engages students and meets their needs. The Australian Secondary Principals Association, ASPA, President Andy Myson said while he has reservations about ACARA being absorbed into one behemoth agency, it could streamline critical support for schools. If the intent is genuine and the design process collaborative and effective, we could build on what is working in the national architecture, remove what isn't working, and consider what might be improved, Myson told The Educator. Provided our school leaders and teachers' professional standing is respected and supported to take a central role in this commission, I view it as another opportunity to focus our collective efforts on building the best system we can for our kids. Early maths under the microscope. Ministers also signed off on a targeted review of the maths curriculum for foundation to year two after teachers reported challenges with the current approach. Earlier this year, a report by the Grattan Institute found that underprepared primary school teachers, ineffective teaching methods and deepening inequities are leaving too many students without the strong foundations they need to succeed in school and life. The study found that maths has taken a backseat in Australian education due to procrastination from governments to rule out faddish but unproven maths teaching methods. Experts from ACARA say early maths is highly cumulative, meaning if students miss the basics, it's hard to catch up later. Federal Education Minister Jason Clare called it the next big step in school reform. A basic grasp of maths is critical. The evidence is really clear. If you get maths, it helps to set you up for success. It's critical for life and work and helps in making better decisions and boosting productivity, Clare said in a statement. Claire said it's critical that young people understand the basics of maths early in life. If you don't get the basics right at the start, you can't build on it, he said. The first 3 years of school are crucial for reading and maths. Every moment counts. Claire pointed to the importance of how maths is taught in classrooms. It is cumulative. You learn it step by step, he said. A number of principals and teachers have told us the current maths curriculum is too complex, while others have told us teachers need more support to implement the curriculum, with clear advice on what to teach in what order. Claire said this was the reasoning for bringing forward work on the current maths curriculum for the start of school and creating better materials to help teachers. Revamping teacher standards. The final reform area at the Education Minister's meeting focused on the National Professional Standards for Teachers, which haven't been updated since 2011. A study led by Queensland University of Technology, QUT, has cast doubt on the credibility of the term classroom ready, a label increasingly used in education policy circles to assess graduate teachers. Associate Professor Rebecca Spooner-Lane, the study's lead author, said that as policymakers grapple with how to stem the exodus from the classroom, there must be a broader, more realistic definition of teacher preparation, one that values not just instructional know-how, but also the resilience, adaptability, and human connection that define great teaching. To address the unrealistic expectation placed upon new teachers to be classroom ready from their first day, education systems and policymakers must adopt a more supportive approach to initial teacher education and early career development, Associate Professor Spooner-Lane told The Educator. It is increasingly the case that new teachers are being sent into schools that are short-staffed and where experienced teachers are feeling burnt out. It is not realistic to expect that new teachers are ready for a workplace that experienced teachers are finding so challenging. The Australian Institute for Teaching and School Leadership, AITSL, has been tasked with scoping a full review of the National Professional Standards for Teachers and will report back to ministers in February 2026. The move follows last year's Teacher Workforce Roundtable, which highlighted the need for clearer expectations, stronger career pathways, and modern professional benchmarks that reflect today's classroom realities. We need standards that reflect what's going on in the classroom today, that back in teachers and support great teaching, Claire said. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much. And up there in New South Wales, they have a very strong Teachers Federation, and they're very concerned about the students who are being systematically denied access to an inclusive education. Let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. Students systemically denied access to inclusive education, and this was published by the New South Wales Teachers Federation on the 30th of October. It is indefensible that students who have been formally assessed and deemed eligible for support classes are left without placement due to a lack of available positions, Federation Vice President Amy Harland told Federation Council in September. If we had 20 kinder students turn up on Monday, we'd create a new class. So why isn't it the same for support classes, she asked, emphasising the right of every student to access education that meets their needs. This failure places an unfair burden on schools and staff, who are then expected to think outside the square and create makeshift solutions, often without the resources, training or structural support required. This is not innovation, it's systemic neglect. We must be clear about the importance of appropriate class compositions, Amy added. Students diagnosed with intellectual disabilities or autism have distinct learning profiles and support needs that differ significantly from those with emotional disturbance or behaviour disorders. Placing these students together in the same support class under the term multi-categorical is not only pedagogically inappropriate, it is detrimental to the well-being and development of students. Amy explained how the government's failure to provide adequate support class placements is detrimental to the well-being and development of students. Not only are these students deprived of equitable access to education, but teachers in mainstream settings are left to manage complex needs without the resources, training, or structural support required, she stressed. Our members deserve a system that backs their expertise, not leaves them to patch the gaps. Our students deserve a system where they are known, valued, and cared for, not just in words, but in actions. Amy highlighted the importance of members organising to address the support class placement shortages, pointing to the recent success of members at Warhope Public School. They had the data and the access requests that warranted an additional support class. However, the department didn't want to establish one, so they worked with the organiser. They were about to walk out when the department caved and established another class, Amy said. It's actions like this we need. It's what our students really need. Federation encourages members to work with their Federation organiser to consider a program of political, community and industrial action in the case of resource denial for students with disability. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you so much, Andy. But now we're going overseas to the US and the UK. And let's hear from our roving expert, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Today we're going to do a story from the States and one from the UK. This one's from Nancy Bailey's education website, which is reposted, was from the October 19th, 25, but it's reposted in the Network for Public Education over there. It's called Remembering Why There's a Special Education Law. And this is regarding the destruction of funding of kids with special needs going to school in the UK, in the US. And I'll begin it. Donald Trump is destroying programs that help Democratic and Republican kids, including special education. He seems not to understand why laws exist to protect students. Linda McMahon, who I just will mention is the Secretary of Education now, is eliminating the US Education Department without congressional approval, which oversees critical federal laws for public schools, including the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is IDEA. So Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. She fired the special education staff, mostly ending the department. Health and Human Services might manage special education, but Health and Human Services is a massive program with problems. There are, in the ARC, an organisation that supports those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, describes why this wouldn't be a good idea. They say, this move might be viewed as promoting a medical model of disability, one that treats disability as a diagnosis to be managed rather than recognising students as learners with potential. Framing students with disabilities through a medical lens risks stigmatising, segregating and isolating them from their peers. It undermines decades of progress towards ensuring that students with disabilities are seen and supported as general education students first. Some believe, that's the end of that quote, some believe states will better provide better accommodations, but history shows this has failed before. It's why a federal mandate was created. McMahon's reckless changes, ending special education without viable solutions, demonstrate a lack of concern for a vulnerable population. Those who've worked in the field over the years, parents and teachers, can certainly think of ways to help public schools better address student needs, including those with special education needs. But that's not what this is about. McMahon has no professional education background to understand schools, students, children with disabilities, or the history of special education, or to make meaningful changes. She's in this role to end services. She repeatedly brags about this, claiming the US Education Department isn't necessary. Instead of better funding for special education, which parents and teachers have demanded for years, she's giving $500 million to charter schools, which are private schools. And sadly, some Democrats will be on board. They've wanted to privatise America's schools for many years. However, in all the years since their existence, charter schools have rarely been a solution for children with disabilities. Students are often counselled out and rejected, especially those with emotional and behavioural disabilities, ADHD, and intellectual and developmental disabilities. Private schools are supposed to serve children with disabilities, but religious schools are exempt. And who's monitoring these schools, which often don't have the resources or the qualified staff to run good programs? Also, importantly, charter schools and private schools don't always include students with disabilities in general classes called inclusion. Charter schools segregate children into disability groups for those with dyslexia or schools for intellectual and developmental disabilities, much like the 1800s, when children stayed at home or were primarily given religious classes. Children don't get opportunities to socialise with their peers, and without oversight, these schools might not assist children to learn and to find independence. McMahon, by not enforcing the law that mandates public schools open their doors to children with disabilities, creates a dangerous situation that will result in children with disabilities sliding backwards in time. Make no mistake, special education has consistently been underfunded, but the belief that every child can learn and be educated is a promise Americans should support and protect. Parents are told the law remains, but a law must be enforced, or it will likely fall apart. Reviewing history is necessary to remember why such a law became significant. Warning. Then she talks about some pictures. In 1965, Burton Blatt and photographer Fred Kaplan began a research project at the Connecticut Center for the Developmentally Disabled. They visited five state institutions in the East and housed individuals with developmental disabilities. Kaplan carried a miniature spy camera on his belt, secretly snapping pictures as they toured the facilities. They never identified the institutions, likely understaffed. Burton Blatt increased our awareness of the inhumane treatment of those with disabilities. As an advocate of deinstitutionalisation, he helped initiate community living programs and family support services. In his clinical work, he emphasised the provision of education to children with severe disabilities, those whom he called clinically homeless. As a national leader in special education, he called for programs to integrate students with disabilities into public schools and worked to promote a more open society for them. Robert F. Kennedy Sr. visited Willowbrook New York State School in 1965. After visiting the school, he said, "I think that the state institution for the mentally retarded, and I think that particularly at Willowbrook, we have a situation that borders on a snake pit, and that children live in filth, and many of our fellow citizens are suffering tremendously because of the lack of attention, lack of imagination, lack of adequate manpower. There is very little future for these children, and for those who are in these institutions, both need tremendous overhauling. I'm not saying that those who are attendants there or who run the institution are at fault. I think all of us are at fault, and I think it's a long overdue that something be done about it, and apologies for the language used there by Robert Kennedy Sr." Obviously, it was 1965 and things have changed. Now, she goes, deinstitutionalisation didn't happen overnight. Special education has evolved and must continue to improve. Sadly, the drive to end public education and more specifically special education will destroy this initiative. Privatisation is about monetising schools, a danger for children with disabilities, especially for those with developmental disabilities. Parents are reminded that IDEA is still in place, but without federal enforcement, it would be hard to get its services. Here's what to watch for and what we've already seen. More unaccountable charter and private schools that exclude children with disabilities. A reduction and end to individual education plans or 504 plan meetings. More charter and private schools lacking inclusion, e.g. schools for dyslexia, autism, etc. Vouchers that won't cover the total cost of private school tuition. Private schools that reject students with disabilities, especially those with more severe disabilities, fewer qualified special education teachers, more unaccountable homeschools, the threat of another eugenics movement, children with difficulties in the classroom being ignored because there are no special education services, unproven online programs or cyber schools known to fail, an increase of religious schools and curriculum, abuse, as there will be less oversight, less teacher preparation and more behavioural difficulties, children sent home or expelled from school or for acting out and not following the rules, a return of badly run state institutions with little oversight. For many who remember 1975 and the beginning of the public law, who fought for children and disabilities to be served in their public schools, ending all Handicapped Children Act, now IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, is a bitter pill. How will America turn this around? There doesn't seem to be any silver lining at this time. The best hope is for a new president who makes education, public schools and special education a priority. That's the end of the article. Now I'm going to go to a completely different complaint. This is but an interesting one nevertheless. This is an article that came out on in MSN Network, which came up as under the State Education in the UK articles. And this paper was written by, I'm just trying to get to it, it's Christina Hopkinson, and it was on the 29th of October. And she writes, "I was sent to a state school, my brother's, to private. It still feels unfair today." So this is a woman who's actually, she's a feminist, and she's lamenting the fact that whilst they've raised the costs of private schools in the UK, girls are being dropped out of private schools more often than boys. So it's about sexism in education as well as the fact that private schools are now having to pay VAT, just like ordinary businesses, which is what they are. Anyway, she writes, "To no one's surprise, private schools are losing pupils since VAT was imposed on fees by the Labor government," I just add. "According to a recently published Independent Schools Council with a survey of 1,150 schools, 81 schools in the UK have closed since July last year, and nearly 17,000 pupils have left the sector, the private school sector, that is. What is less expected is that girls' schools are hemorrhaging pupils at a rate far faster than boys' schools or co-ed schools. In fact, it's the boys-only schools that are faring the least worst, losing 2.7% of their pupils compared to 4.5% among the girls. Amid talk of toxic masculinity and sexual harassment in schools, exposed by the Everyone's Invited movement, it might have been anticipated that parents would be doing all that they could to keep their daughters in the safe environs of a private girls' school. Could it be that parents are more willing in 2025 to spend money on keeping their sons in private schools and taking their chances with the state system for their sisters? Of course, girls' education being a secondary consideration has a long lineage. The boys' public schools were established more than 400 years before the first ones for girls, while the University of Cambridge didn't officially offer women's degrees until after the Second World War. Even in my lifetime, this was my experience growing up in the 1980s in rural East Anglia. Among my parents' friends, landowning, horsey, vaguely Jilly Cooper-esque, the girls were educated very differently to their brothers. Think Diana, later Princess of Wales, leaving school with no O levels, and her brother Charles going to Oxford. I went to the local state primary and then the nearest cheapest secondary my parents could find, staffed by nuns without teaching qualifications, in large classes, while my brothers were packed off to cold but expensive boarding schools at the age of 7 or 8 before going on to famous public schools. I don't envy them, and I certainly the experience of being sent away from home at such a young age was traumatic, but it's notable that my parents spent around 4 times as much on their education as mine. It wasn't just me. My husband, similarly, was sent to boarding school while his sisters could go to the local school. When girls were sent to board, the schools were far from academic powerhouses. The favourite among my parents' set was rumoured to give everyone a day off when a pupil got a university place. Boys, meanwhile, were off to Eton and Winchester. Of course, whining about which type of education my parents paid for brings out the world's tiniest violin, which I'd probably be able to play to grade 8 if I'd gone to a better school, but to my Bolshevik feminist self, it rankled. There was an abiding sense that it mattered more for boys because, after all, they were going to be the breadwinners. Amongst those pony club girls I grew up with, few went to university. I did well academically, thanks to 2 fantastic, well-qualified history teachers, and went on to Oxford University, but there I still felt the imposter syndrome common to those lacking the public school confidence of so many of our peers. Years later, my father was chuckling about my schooling, and I asked him why he'd sent me there. "You don't understand," he said. "Girls' education just wasn't a priority back then." Reminder, it was the 1980s, not the 1880s. Surely in 21st century Britain, nobody values the education of their sons over that of their daughters. The figures suggest that, yes, they do, marginally. According to the ISC survey, there are nearly 3% more boys in private schools than girls. The difference is more marked in boarding schools, which around 14% more boys attend. Grace Moody Stewart, director of the Good Schools Guide Education Consultants, assures me that in her experience of advising hundreds of families, parents are not distinguishing between their sons and daughters. They're far too modern for that. They aren't doing that sort of thing. Let's send our daughter to the local school and our son off to the boarding school. I can't think of one instance where I've heard them express a desire to send a daughter somewhere cheaper. And yet, anecdotally, when I look at the families I know, when one child is educated less expensively, it's always the girl. Either by going to a day school and their brother to boarding, or by going to state school while the boy is educated privately, just like me, all of those years ago. None of their parents would say that this is because they value their daughter's education less, but coincidentally or otherwise, it's always the boys whose needs require high spending. My son just needs vast amounts of sports. If he isn't running around twice a week with the opportunity to be in a team, he'd go mad. The local state just does basketball, says one parent whose son is at an independent day school and a daughter at a state school. Another whose son is at Eton while his sister is at day school says that it's never been their intention, but then you go and see these boys' school and they blow your mind. They just aren't the equivalents for girls. As father told me when all his nines and A stars daughter... My father told me that when his all nines and A stars daughter... That means that she got good marks, that her ambition was to marry a banker, and he thought maybe he should regret the thousands he spent on her education. Perhaps some parents made choices based on subconscious expectations that men will be the main breadwinners in the future. In the state sector, there are more single-sex girls remaining and many are high achieving. Local to me, for example, a Honeypot girls' school has three-quarters of its pupils getting above grade 5 in English and maths GCSE, an average of B-plus at A-levels. The nearest boys' school, just over half the GCSE and an average of C at A-levels. For this reason, many parents logically take their chances with the state girls' school. If you've got a really good girls' state school, then of course parents are going to consider taking up a thriving free place, says Grace Moody Stewart. This reflects what was said to me by one parent. A good state girls' school is inevitably better than an okay boys' one. In fact, the boys' equivalents around us sinks because generally boys are more of a problem than girls. This is borne out by research from the FFT Data Lab, which found that even after adjusting for socioeconomic background, pupils at a girls' school achieved 10% better GCSE grades in 2023. There was no boost at all for boys in boys' schools. It's not only that girls are being taken out of fee-paying education, their schools are also closing at a faster rate. While much of this is being blamed on VAT and other factors, such as more boys' schools being co-ed, the truth is that they are always more vulnerable to financial hits. Anna Paul is the head of South Hampstead High School, part of the Girls' Day School Trust. Of the 26 girls' schools across the UK, while her school is an affluent part of London and is flourishing, she's conscious of the reasons why others are struggling. Historically, girls' schools haven't had the endowments or financial legacies of boys' schools to help shore them up. VAT is the final straw for many of them. Of course, it's easy to argue the insignificance of a few schools closing in a sector that only educates 7% of UK pupils, but she worries that it can be seen as a reflection of a wider problem. What an indictment it would be if we didn't notice that girls' schools were being impacted nationally. That would be a statement of not caring about girls and not showing commitment to equality. Other private head teachers have warned that the decline of girls' schools is a backward step for equality, as girls are more likely to take subjects such as physics, computer science and maths and take part in male-dominated sports such as football when they go to a single-sex institution. Alex Hutchinson, president of the Girls' School Association and headmistress of James Allen's School in Dulwich, South London, said last year that the imposing of VAT could have a seismic impact on a girl's life chances. Perhaps I'm wrong to associate money spent with value given to my education or those of girls today. I ended up doing better academically than my smarter brothers, as is the case for almost all the girls I see in the same position today. All these years on, though, I'm still left with that sibling battle cry of, "It's not fair." And with that, I'm going to let you make what you can of that. We, of course, have zero sympathy for private schools, but we do have sympathy for the fact that education for women should be identical to that of men in every value placed on them, of course, which is just common sense. Anyway, with that, before I get myself into trouble, I'm going to head back to the headquarters of the dogs and wish you a nice weekend. Cheerio.
I think it's time to have a break and come back for all our good news stories.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, we hope that you've had a bit of a break there, because we're coming back to the best part of our program, the good news stories. And this is a really good news story. It's about a school up there in the Riverina with a lot of very disadvantaged students who do the most wonderful work. And this school, together with its principal and others and its teachers and its students, is a STEM powerhouse. Let's hear about it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. Australia's most surprising STEM powerhouse. And this was written by Brett Hennebury and published in The Educator on the 31st of October. When you think of world-class STEM innovation, you might picture high-tech city labs or wealthy independent schools, not a regional high school surrounded by farmland. Yet Murrumbidgee Regional High School Griffith in country New South Wales is proving that brilliance can thrive anywhere. At the Australian Education Awards 2025 in Sydney on August the 8th, the school took out the Streets Science Best STEM Program Award, beating some of the nation's most highly resourced schools in Australia. But this win is just the surface of something bigger, a bold, inclusive model that's redefining what STEM looks like in Australia and giving every student, no matter their postcode, a genuine shot at success. Dr. Scott Sleep, who led the development of the STEM Industry School Partnerships Program for the New South Wales Department of Education in 2017, is a Winston Churchill Fellow who has explored STEM programs around the world. Speaking to the educator on the sidelines of the Australian Education Awards 2025 in August, he said there is nothing that even comes close to what Murrumbidgee Regional High School Griffith is doing in STEM. I'm just so proud to be a public educator and so proud of what the school has done, Dr. Sleep told the educator. We've all come from regional areas, but as part of what we've been doing in STEM, we've been able to travel the world and look at exemplary STEM programs. And what I've got to say is there is no better STEM program, not only in Australia, but the world, than what's happening in Murrumbidgee Regional High School Griffith. Below, the educator speaks to Ian Preston, Deputy Principal at Murrumbidgee Regional High School Griffith, who has been the driving force behind this success. Firstly, congratulations to the school on being awarded the Street Science Best STEM Program. In your own words, what do you believe makes an effective STEM program in 2025? Thank you. We're honoured to receive the Street Science Best STEM Program Award. In our view, an effective STEM program in 2025 is designed to empower students through a balance of explicit teaching of foundational concepts and hands-on, inquiry-based learning that sparks curiosity, deepens understanding, and promotes real-world problem-solving. It must provide multiple access points, whether creative, analytical, collaborative, or technical, so all learners can engage meaningfully and see where a STEM journey can take them. Above all, strong STEM programs build aspiration and confidence in students by connecting them with role models, mentors, and lived experiences, and by raising awareness of current and future career opportunities, especially for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students, girls, students in rural or remote areas, and those from low socioeconomic backgrounds. While students remain at the centre, a critical success factor is building teacher confidence and capability to deliver integrated cross-curricular learning with relevance and impact. These programs must be underpinned by effective, sustainable partnerships with industry, universities, and the wider community, giving students greater access to high-quality STEM learning and clearer pathways to further education and employment. How are the Murrumbidgee Academy of STEM Excellence and the New South Wales Virtual STEM Academy helping students, especially those who have traditionally struggled with STEM, to overcome their learning barriers in this important subject? The Murrumbidgee Academy of STEM Excellence, MACE, and the New South Wales Virtual STEM Academy, VSA, are transforming the STEM journey for students, especially those in rural, regional and remote communities, and students who are female, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, or from low socioeconomic backgrounds. These programs build STEM ability, engagement and aspiration through high-quality, hands-on learning in areas such as forensics, electronics, coding, agritech, advanced manufacturing, and Indigenous seasonal knowledge. Students benefit from world-leading resources and opportunities, including mentoring with STEM professionals and participation in international competitions and project-based challenges that foster teamwork, creativity, and innovation. Through strong partnerships with industry, universities, and community organisations, students connect with real-world STEM contexts and career pathways. Most importantly, MACE and VSA help students develop confidence, a sense of belonging, and the belief that they can thrive in STEM, empowering them to pursue further education, training, and meaningful futures in Australia's evolving STEM landscape. Your STEM program has been described by the New South Wales Department of Education's STEM lead as perhaps the world's best. What do you believe makes Murrumbidgee Regional High School Griffith's STEM program stand out from the rest? Murrumbidgee Regional High School Griffith's STEM program stands out because it is built on a bold, inclusive and future-focused vision that extends far beyond the classroom. At its core is the Murrumbidgee Academy of STEM Excellence, MACE, a model that combines high-impact pedagogy, cutting-edge resources and meaningful real-world connections. The program supports students from kindergarten to year 12 to our learning community, providing a clear, connected STEM learning pathway from primary to secondary school. Central to its success is a strong focus on building STEM educator capacity through professional learning and mentoring programs that empower teachers to deliver integrated cross-curricular STEM education. It also works to improve the quality and quantity of STEM instruction, particularly across regional, rural, remote, and underrepresented communities. With a deep commitment to equity, the program enhances teacher confidence and capacity, increases student engagement and aspiration, and improves outcomes for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students, girls, and those from low socioeconomic backgrounds. A key driver of the program is a dedicated full-time STEM project officer who leads both MACE and the New South Wales Virtual STEM Academy, NSWVSA, and actively collaborates with local, national and international STEM educators and professionals, drawing on learnings from high-performing schools and maintaining ongoing dialogue with global experts to inform strategic direction. This outward-looking and evidence-informed leadership ensures that the program remains globally aligned, locally responsive, and at the forefront of innovative STEM education. Students engage in hands-on, inquiry-rich learning in areas such as agri-tech, forensics, electronics, coding, advanced manufacturing, space, and Indigenous seasonal knowledge. Through sustained partnerships with industry, universities and community organisations, students are connected to real-world STEM contexts, mentors and career pathways. They gain access to world-leading resources and experiences and regularly participate in national and international competitions like the First Lego League and Science and Engineering Challenge, fostering collaboration, creativity and confidence. Beyond the classroom, the program actively raises awareness of current and future STEM opportunities among students, families, and the wider community, ensuring more equitable transitions to further education, training, and employment. Supported by the MACE Lending Library, school networks, and system-wide outreach, the program continues to scale its impact, inspiring a new generation of confident, capable STEM learners and leaders. The Future Skills Organisation states that Australia is projected to face a shortfall of 370,000 digital workers by 2026. Looking ahead, how will Murrumbidgee Regional High School Griffith be evolving or expanding its STEM program to ensure young people enrolling at the school are equipped with the skills they'll need to thrive in a workforce likely to be dominated by AI and automation? Murrumbidgee Regional High School Griffith is continually evolving its STEM program to equip students with the skills, knowledge and mindset required to thrive in a workforce shaped by AI, automation and emerging technologies. Through the Murrumbidgee Academy of STEM Excellence, MACE, and the New South Wales Virtual STEM Academy, students participate in high-impact hands-on learning across fields such as AI, robotics, coding, electronics, and data science. These technical experiences are complemented by the development of key capabilities including problem-solving, collaboration, creativity, and adaptability. The program keeps students informed about future workforce directions through mentoring, real-world engagement, and strong partnerships with industry and universities. Rapidly expanding and future-focused, it also prioritises teacher capability, providing ongoing professional learning to ensure educators are confident and equipped to deliver integrated, relevant and forward-thinking STEM education from primary through to senior years. It just sounds like an absolutely amazing program, doesn't it? Back to you, Jean.
Well, you wouldn't have to be a prophet or the son of a prophet or daughter of a prophet to work out what our Great State School of the Week is.
And this week's Great State School of the Week is Murrumbidgee Regional High School Griffith. Murrumbidgee Regional High School Griffith is a government-funded, co-educational, comprehensive secondary day school located in Griffith, a city in the Riverina region of New South Wales. Re-established this year as a separate high school after an unpopular and unsuccessful merge with Wade High School in 2019, the school has recently been awarded the Street Science Best STEM Program. This win was at the 2025 Australian Education Awards held in August. There is surprisingly little on the internet about this school. It is not in the business of advertising itself like private schools, just getting on with the business of education with extraordinary dedicated principal, teachers and support staff and enthusiastic country students, and making the educational press with news of its excellence. Given the socio-economic profile of the school, the results are astonishing. And now some facts and figures from the My School website, the enrolment 576, and the ICSEA value well below average at 918, representative of a very diverse regional community. Students with parents in the upper 25% of incomes make up 5% of the school population. Second level of parental income, 13%. And 26% of students have parents in the third quartile of incomes, and the lowest quartile of incomes make up 57% of students, with 35% having a language background other than English and 19% Indigenous students. The finances are recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $2.5 million, Victorian Government $8.9 million, private fees, etc., $130,653, and other private contributions, about $56,000. And that works out at $20,681 per pupil. The capital, $1.86 million over 3 years. All money well spent. A truly great school. Back to you, Jane.
Well, congratulations to Murrumbidgee Regional High School at Griffith. To tell you the truth, I've never seen NAPLAN results like them. They're all way up in the above average. But we'd like to remind you how important our public schools are. And there's a rally on Wednesday, the 12th of November, at the office of Anthony Carbines, MP, at 149 Burgundy Street, Heidelberg, 4:30 p.m. Be there or be square. And it's up to me now to thank Dale, our wonderful producer, and her offsider, Andy, and Jeff, of course, and to remind you about our website at www.adogs.info. But from Dale and Andy and Jeff and myself, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au and thanks for your support.